My name is Shredda, and this is The Lightner Side of Things, Practitioner Perspectives in School Psychology, a place for school psychology practitioners to come together and share experiences and insights about their work. I'm very excited today to talk with Dr. Linda Getman. How are you doing, Linda?
I am doing wonderful. Thank you for asking. And good. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you.
Good.
Hanging in there in self-isolation.
Oh, yes.
So tell us a little bit about yourself.
Okay. Well, I've had a very exciting career in the sense that I've been at this for about 25 years now. I started out in this little tiny, literally in the middle of a cornfield district in the southern tier of New York State. I had the whole entire district to myself. There was about 900 or some odd students in two different buildings, and the buildings were practically right next to each other. So it was a small campus. I had K through 12. It was my first job out of the gate. And as a matter of fact, the day that I walked in to start my internship supervisor walked out to go take a job at a different district. So, So my internship year was actually my first year of practice. Fortunately, I was an older student. I was a mom with two kids at the time. It was in 1996 or something like that. And so I wasn't quite as intimidated as I probably would have been had I been a first year student with, no kids and, younger. So yeah, that was exciting. That was very exciting. And the fun part is that the person who came before me had been half time. So this was their first venture into having a full-time school psychologist. And I pretty much got to make the job my own. It was exciting. I held parent workshops and I wrote for the parents and I had newsletters and I did groups up, up the yin yang. And it was fun. It was great fun.
It sounds so cool.
It was very cool. But, one of our colleagues this morning talked about selective mutism. And I texted that person and said, I wish I'd had that information and you back when I started, because my second day on the job, I was presented with this little first grade child who was a selective mute, and it was here. Fix her. No. Anyway, and everything that had been done the year before had been, and not necessarily from my colleague, but the teachers. The teachers had done everything that you shouldn't do to the student. So, let me take the student that we've really, really discombobulated and give it to you and fix it. And I think from that was born the notion of limitations for me. I have limitations. I had to do a lot of research. I did a lot of talking to other colleagues. But sometimes the best you can do is just the best you can do. So that was my first 4 years, and then moved to Delaware with my then husband and started, he landed in Lewis, Delaware. So for many years I was in districts where I may be one of two or three school psychologists. One district was five buildings and two of us. And so there was a lot of pressure, cover that in your daily practice. And again, knowing your limits and knowing that there were some things I just couldn't do, not only because this was beyond my scope of practice at the time, but also because I had two and a half buildings.
Right.
And so, so it was very challenging. And then I moved up to a different district where I'm now part of an entourage of school psychologists. And it's very, very exciting to be part of a team of bigger than two. So I've seen a lot. Let me see. This would be within this particular state. One, two, three. My fifth district. So when we talk about practice, when we talk about school psychology practice, it is so different in every district. And even within the district, it's different in every building. So it's almost as though you have to reinvent yourself every time you walk in the door that you're walking in, because this is a totally different building culturally than the building you just left. So it's been fun. It's been exciting. I tell people I probably wouldn't have any other job in the world because I am never bored. So, it's been a wild ride, and I'm coming to the end of the ride, and I'm excited for that too.
I'm sure. That's so interesting that you talked about having to kind of develop yourself or become a new person every time you move to a different district. I'd never thought about that before.
Mm-hmm. Yes, because the expectations are different. The people who came before me in some of those districts did things differently. And so it was a matter of sort of scooting them along. So I will meet some of those expectations, but some of those expectations we have to renegotiate because that's not on my plate, kind of a thing. It's been fun. It's always a challenge to maintain your own identity while at the same time trying to meet their expectations, needs, and wants. So it's
absolutely.
Yeah. And I was president of the state association for 2 years, and for 6 years I served as the state delegate to NASP, to the National Association. Those were always learning, growing, exciting experiences that I'm so glad that I had.
So you had two full-time jobs, if not more, at the time.
Yes, I did. Yes,
essentially.
Yeah, because I also, for several years, I was an adjunct faculty member at Wilmington. Well, first it was Wilmington College and then Wilmington University.
Oh, gosh.
So apparently I really like to be stressed.
I would say so, but it's very admirable. And your contributions to the field, I'm just beginning to learn about all of it, but are really valuable. You did talk about limitations and having to develop those limitations, and when you move to a new place, having to renegotiate expectations, which is, I like the way you phrased that. So along those lines, let's talk about self-care.
Okay.
I feel like self-care, the term self-care, has been a buzzword lately. Even before COVID in the school psychology community. I think, we're in a time where we were starting to realize that we can't take care of ourselves until we're taking care, or we can't take care of others, rather, until we're taking care of ourselves. What does self-care as a school psychologist mean to you?
Well, thank you for asking that. What it means to me, and this has been my soapbox. First of all, let me get this out of the way. This has been my soapbox for years.
Please.
My soapbox for years. I would tell my interns this. I would tell my students this. Anybody who needed to hear this, it came out of my mouth. Don't work 24/7. we as a profession have gone through a lot of transformations, and there are times and situations and administrators and buildings and all kinds of people who want us to do it all and to be it all and to work 24/7. So in other words, I had one particular intern who was determined to prove that she was up to the job. That's lovely. But she was single at the time, and she was fresh out of school, and she wanted to establish herself as a competent professional. And that's wonderful. And so she would spend her days taking care of the kids, and then she would take all of her paperwork home and write her reports at night. And I strongly, this is not a good idea. I don't think it's a good idea. First of all, I think that self-care means you have some boundaries. So when I walk in my house, I want it to feel like my house, not my second office. This is my sanctuary. This is where I walk in the door and I breathe a deep sigh of relief and I kick off my shoes and I'm home. You can't have that feeling if you're always bringing work home, if you're always bringing it home with you. So that's one thing about that. The other thing is you're establishing a precedent. So some of the situations I walked into, I had to firmly establish the fact that this isn't what I do. I don't take work home. I will spend extra time at the office if it's absolutely necessary in order to be prepared for tomorrow's meeting. I don't take work home. I don't want that to become the bar by which you rate my performance, nor do I want that to become the bar by which the next poor soul has to meet. So, sometimes I walked into situations where my predecessor had established that as the bar and I had to reestablish this. It's also a fast road to burnout. I also don't think that you're being fair to your district, because if in fact I'm in a district where there's two school psychologists, okay, I was, and the expectation was that you will get it done. You're going to get everything done. But, ooh, you may have to take a little bit home in order to get it done. Then I'm not teaching you that this is more than a two-person job. I have to, right? So if I'm doing the work of four people, you don't get to understand that this is a four-person job.
Right.
That's my soapbox. So setting those limits. So self-care is often about knowing your limits and setting your limits and being firm in your limits. You talked at one point about the hard no. And sometimes there is a hard no. My other phrase is, if there's no blood and there's no imminent death, it can wait. It can wait until I've paused and sussed out the situation and figured what the appropriate response is. But I think sometimes we don't do that because we need to be seen as competent and responsive. So,
yes, I completely agree with that. And I love that you said, this is not the bar by which you rate my performance. I think that probably will resonate with a lot of school psychologists out there. And you know, I've thought a lot about this in the past few months about the culture that we kind of perpetuate amongst ourselves, and not just in the school psychology field, but maybe in education in general, about who we label as dedicated and who we label as average. And I see that a lot where, you know, the teacher or the school psychologist who's working over time every single day and maybe writing reports on weekends is considered or perceived as very dedicated and loyal and a good psychologist. Whereas, you know, another psychologist who maybe is not doing those things, maybe is going home at the end of the workday to spend time with their family, pick their kids up from school, or maybe just wants to cook a healthy dinner for themselves. is not necessarily perceived the same way. So I wonder why is it that we're not really valuing the work that's put in during the day? And we're valuing all of these unhealthy habits more so. And I think that tends to be more of a cultural issue with us.
I think you're completely right. I think we have a culture of extremes, frankly. You're either a superhero or you're a slug. I think that part of the culture that we have, not only part of it is a reflection of where I think the culture in America has gone, by and large. In the sense that, you know, everybody has to be faster, stronger, braver, smarter, thinner, more wealthy than their neighbor, keeping up with the Joneses aspect. But in terms of our profession, in terms of our profession specifically, some of this is fear driven. And I think you and I touched upon this one day when we were chatting, that we are operating out of fear. And historically speaking, once upon a time, the fear came from becoming obsolete. So, you know, once upon a time, we were the gatekeepers, and then spec ed in itself started to get a little under the microscope, and IQ testing began to become out of favor. And people got very, very nervous that if we weren't mandated, if the IQ test wasn't mandated in order to be able to get into special ed, then what are we going to do? We're going to lose our jobs. And I was actually, I think I was president at the time. People were completely wigging out over losing their jobs. And I just kept saying, well, then we have to add more. We have to add more to our toolkit. We can't be just the whisk givers, right? We have to expand our repertoire. I can't know everything. I can't. I don't want to. Again, limits, right? I can't answer your question right now, but I can find the resources to come up with a reasonable answer. See me in 24 hours. So in a sense, we're still driven by fear, only instead of the fear of becoming obsolete, now we have the fear of not knowing.
You're right. We have become kind of holders of buzzwords. And lately it is trauma-informed care, MTSS, all things that are important. But I mean, you had mentioned this at one point when we were talking before about not taking ourselves too seriously. We tend to take ourselves way too seriously and feel like we have to be the answer to everything. And that's not always the case, even though, you know, like you said, there is a part of that is fear driven. We want to make sure we are at the table or represented in some way, which I believe is necessary. But you're also right in that we don't have to be there for every single thing. We don't have to have all the answers.
Well, I hope not, because then I would be an abject failure, because I do not have all of the answers. And so as we look at self-care, okay, to me, right now, mindfulness and self-care are coming across as things like a routine of boxes that we have to check. We need to meditate. We need to listen to music. We need to do yoga. We need to eat our chocolate slowly. We need to you know, take care of ourselves and make sure that it's just another list of to-do level, right? So to me, self-care is different things for different people at different times. So for example, there are days, a lot of days, where I just take that pile of paper, I shove it in the file drawer because I like to come into a clean desk, I lock everything up and I walk out the door, because I have this life that happens outside of the workforce. And then there are days when, for me, self-care is staying until 6 o'clock to finish that final thing that I need to do so that tomorrow I can walk in and be ready to face the day. So Would working until 6 o'clock be on everybody's self-care list? No. But for me, I chose that because I want my tomorrow to be better. So I think sometimes self-care is as complicated as that checkbox. I think sometimes it's as simple as pausing to self-assess, be aware of your needs at the moment, and then honor yourself by meeting those needs. So I think
checking in with yourself.
Yes, just do self-check. You know, how am I feeling right now? Why am I feeling like I've had 18 cups of coffee? Is it because my external forces are too great and I'm letting them drive me? Or is it because I really had too much coffee? You know, it's like, and yes, we did talk about the fact that sometimes we do take ourselves too seriously. Do not mistake me. I take my job seriously. I don't always take myself seriously because you know what? I'm not the be all and the end all. I'm not all that in a bag of chips. I'm just a human being trying to do the best I can in the situation that's been given me with the tools that I have at my disposal. And my self-care is recognizing that and being able to respect myself for that.
Yeah, and actually, as you were talking, I was thinking about, you know, what does that mean for us as school psychologists? Because a lot of us, I think, are just inherently very competitive type A personalities.
No.
And so, I mean, what does that mean for the future of our field and actually also for graduate school programs who kind of train their students to be in the mindset that school psychologists are at the very top? And we are, again, like you said, don't get me wrong. I do believe we are highly trained, highly skilled professionals, and we should be at the table and represented well. But again, you know, how do we reconcile those things? How do we reconcile being that, doing that, and looking after our own well-being?
That's going to be a trick, isn't it? That's going to be a huge trick. And it's funny because as you were talking, it reminded me of a sort of a personal rule that I have in terms of how full my plate is. So what I'll do is someone will ask me to do something and I'll look at my plate and I'll think, I can do that. There's room on my plate. Or I can do that, but then I have to take something else off. There has to be some give and take. So I remember being in one district where I was being bullied, frankly, into doing everything. My colleague had to take a leave. There was only two of us in the district, and I was being asked to do everything in the district. And so I made a list. I made a list of what that meant in terms of the projects I had already started in my buildings, plus everything else that was going on in that other person's building. And I presented my boss with the list and I said, we need to pick because it can't all get done. So I can do this much. I can't. I think that as a profession, we need to start teaching our students and teaching each other how to understand limits, how to understand, yes, there's a lot out there to know. How about if you pick one thing and become really, really conversant in it and then just sort of skim over the other two things, know enough to know what you don't know. So when the boss comes and says, hey, I need X number of volunteers, and you sit there and you think, well, if I don't volunteer, will I be seen as not pulling my own weight? If I don't do this in the school, am I going to be seen as a good ambassador for my profession, or am I letting my profession down? Am I doing the right thing, saying the right thing, being enough? Am I doing enough? And if I do all of this, am I going to live long enough to see retirement? At some point in time, we need to take a deep breath and pause and truly have some courageous conversations with each other.
On that note, well, I like it. I like the idea of courageous conversations. And I think we definitely need to do a lot more of that in all aspects of our practice. That's the only way we're going to be able to kind of move forward and make any real change. And, you know, I'll just kind of bring it back to what I said before, and I think everyone can agree on, we can't take care of others until we're taking care of ourselves first. And I think it's important for us to be models of what that looks like.
Exactly. And some of that is also just asking, right? Just asking. I need some space. I need some time. I need somebody to listen to me. I need somebody to answer this question because I don't get it. Yes. What are my needs? Do I even know what my needs are? But yeah, it's okay to ask. It's okay to ask for respect. It's okay to ask for time. It's okay to put up those limits, put up those boundaries, and then live within them. Know yourself and take care of yourself.
This is why, you know, I really would, I'm interested in talking to school psychologists in all points of their careers. And this is one of the reasons why I really wanted to talk with you about this topic, because you're very experienced and you've been a lot of different places. You've seen it all. And to have a courageous conversation like that, you have to have someone who's kind of in your shoes.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. And this has been fun.
This has been fun. And thank you so much for chatting. We definitely have to do this again.
Absolutely. And thank you so much for inviting me.
Thank you so much for listening to The Leitner Side of Things. If you have any feedback or topic ideas, let me know on Twitter. My Twitter handle is @SGERA99. See you at the next episode.